Chapter 5. Quivering in the lucid waters of the Golden Horn, where the yellow Tiber flows under broken bridges and over imperial glories, where the huts are squatted by the Niger under the palm trees, where the northern Babel lies with its warehouses and its bridges, its graceful factory chimneys, and its clumsy fanes hidden in fog and smoke by the dirtiest river in the world. In all the cities of mankind there is one home, whither men of one family may resort. Over the entire world spreads a vast brotherhood, suffering, silent, scattered, sympathizing, waiting an immense Freemasonry. Once this world spread be, and was an Arabian clan, a little nation alone, and outlying amongst the mighty monarchies of ancient time, the megatheria of history. The sails of their rare ships might be seen in the Egyptian waters, the camels of their caravans might thread the sands of Baalbek, or wind through the date groves of Damascus. Their flag was raised, not ingloriously, in many wars, against mighty odds, but was a small people, and on one dark night the Lion of Judah went down before Vespasian's eagles, and in flame, and death, and struggle, Jerusalem agonized and died. Yes, the Jewish city is lost to Jewish men, but have they not taken the world in exchange? Mused thus Godfrey de Bouillon, Marquis of Kidlingsby, as he debouched from Wych Street into the Strand. He had been to take a box for Armida at Madame Vestris's theater. That little Armida was full of Madame Vestris's theater, and her little brougham, and her little self, and her enormous eyes, and her prodigious opera glass, and her miraculous bouquet, which cost Lord Kidlingsby 20 guineas every evening at Nathan's in Covent Garden. The children of the gardeners of Sharon have still no rival for flowers, might be seen 3 nights in the week at least, in the narrow, charming, comfortable little theater. Godfrey at the box. He was strolling, listlessly, eastward, and the above thoughts passed through the young noble's mind as he came in sight of Holywell Street. The occupants of the London ghetto sat at their porches basking in the evening sunshine. Children were playing on the steps. Fathers were smoking at the lintel. Smiling faces looked out from the various and darkling draperies with which the warehouses were hung. Ringlets glossy and curly and jetty, eyes black as night, midsummer night when it lightens. Haughty noses bending like beaks of eagles, eager quivering nostrils, lips curved like the bow of love. Every man or maiden, every babe or matron in that English jury bore in his countenance one or more of these characteristics of his peerless Arab race. How beautiful they are, mused Kidlingsby, as he surveyed these placid groups calmly taking their pleasure in the sunset. Do you want to look at a nishkoot? A voice said, which made him start. And then someone behind him began handling a masterpiece of Stoltz's with a familiarity which would have made the Baron tremble. Raphael Mendoza! Exclaimed Godfrey. The same, Lord Kidlingsby, the individual so apostrophized replied. Told you we should meet again, where you would little expect me. Will it please you to enter? This is Friday, and we close at sunset. It rejoices my heart to welcome you home. So saying, Raphael laid his hand on his breast, and bowed, an oriental reverence. All traces of the accent with which he first addressed Lord Kidlingsby had vanished. It was disguise. Half the Hebrew's life is a disguise. He shields himself in craft, since the Norman boors persecuted him. They passed under an awning of old clothes, tawdry fripperies, greasy spangles, and battered masks, into a shop as black and hideous as the entrance was foul. Is your home, Raphael? Said Lord Kidlingsby. Why not? Raphael answered. I'm tired of Schloss Schinkenstein. The Rhine bores me after a while. It is too hot for Florence. Besides, they have not completed the picture gallery, and my place smells of putty. You wouldn't have a man, monsieur, bury himself in his chateau in Normandy, out of the hunting season? The Rugentino Palace stupefies me. Those Titians are so gloomy, I shall have my Habimas and Teniers's, I think, from my house at The Hague hung over them. How many castles, palaces, houses, warehouses, shops, have you, Raphael? Lord Kidlingsby asked, laughing. This is one, Raffle answered. Omen. 2. The noise in the old town was terrific. Great Tom was booming sullenly over the uproar. The bell of St. Mary's was clanging with alarm. St. Giles' tocsin chimed furiously. Howls, curses, flights of brickbats, stones shivering windows, groans of wounded men, cries of frightened females, cheers of either contending party as it charged the enemy from Carfax to Trumpington Street, proclaimed that the battle was at its height. In Berlin they would have said it was a revolution, and the cuirassiers would have been charging, saber in hand, amidst that infuriate mob. In France they would have brought down artillery, and played on it with 24-pounders. In Cambridge nobody heeded the disturbance, it was a town and gown row. The row arose at a boat race. The town boat, manned by 8 stout bargees, with the redoubted rowlock for stroke, had bumped the brazenous light oar, usually at the head of the river. High words arose regarding the dispute. After returning from Grantchester, when the boats pulled back to Christchurch Meadows, the disturbance between the townsmen and the university youths, their invariable opponents, grew louder and more violent, until it broke out in open battle. Sparring and skirmishing took place along the pleasant fields that lead from the university gate down to the broad and shining waters of the Cam, and under the walls of Balliol and Sidney Sussex. The Duke of Bellomont, then a dashing young sizar at Exeter, had a couple of rounds with Billy Butt, the bow oar of the bargee boat. Vavasor of Brazenus was engaged with a powerful butcher, a well-known champion of the town party, when, the great university bells ringing to dinner, truce was called between the combatants, and they retired to their several colleges for refection. During the boat race, a gentleman pulling in a canoe, and smoking a narghilé, had attracted no ordinary attention. He rode about 100 yards ahead of the boats in the race, so that he could have a good view of that curious pastime. If the 8 oars neared him, with a few rapid strokes of his flashing paddles his boat shot a furlong ahead. Then he would wait, surveying the race, and sending up volumes of odor from his cool narghilé. Who is he? Asked the crowds who panted along the shore, encouraging, according to Cambridge wont, the efforts of the oarsmen in the race. Town and gown alike asked who it was, who, with an ease so provoking, in a bark so singular, with a form seemingly so slight, but a skill so prodigious, beat their best men. No answer could be given to the query, save that a gentleman in a dark traveling chariot, preceded by 6 Fergans and a courier, had arrived the day before at the Oop Inn, opposite Brazenus, and that the stranger of the canoe seemed to be the individual in question. No wonder the boat, that all admired so, could compete with any that ever was wrought by Cambridge artificer or Putney workman. That boat slim, shining, and shooting through the water like a pike after a small fish was a cake from Topana. It had distanced the Sultan's oarsmen, and the best crews of the Captain Pasha in the Bosphorus. It was the workmanship of Togrul Beg, KG Bashi of His Highness. The Bashi had refused 50,000 tomans from Count Boutenoff, the Russian ambassador, for that little marvel. When his head was taken off, the father of believers presented the boat to Raffle Mendoza. It was Raffle Mendoza that saved the Turkish monarchy after the Battle of Nezib. By sending 3 millions of piastres to the Saraskier, by bribing Colonel de Saint Cornichon, the French envoy in the camp of the victorious Ibrahim, the march of the Egyptian army was stopped, the menaced empire of the Ottomans was saved from ruin. The Marchioness of Stakepagis, our ambassador's lady, appeared in a suite of diamonds which outblazed even the Romanov jewels, and Raffle Mendoza obtained the little cake. He never traveled without it. It was scarcely heavier than an armchair. Baroni, the courier, had carried it down to the Cam that morning, and Raffle had seen the singular sport which we have mentioned. The dinner over, the young men rushed from their colleges, flushed, full-fed, and eager for battle. If the gown was angry, the town, too, was on the alert. from Ifley and Barnwell, from factory and mill, from wharf and warehouse. The town poured out to meet the enemy, and their battle was soon general. From the Addenbrookes Hospital to the Blenheim Turnpike, all Cambridge was in an uproar. The college gates closed, the shops barricaded, the shopboys away in support of their brother townsmen. The battle raged, and the gown had the worst of the fight. A luncheon of many courses had been provided for Raffle Mendoza at his inn, but he smiled at the clumsy efforts of the university cooks to entertain him, and a couple of dates and a glass of water formed his meal. In vain the discomfited landlord pressed him to partake of the slighted banquet. "Breakfast, sir," said he. "My good man, I have 19 cooks, at salaries rising from 400 a year. I can have a dinner at any hour, but a town and gown row, a brickbat here flying through the window, crashed the carafe of water in Mendoza's hand. Town and gown row is a novelty to me. The town has the best of it, clearly, though. The men outnumber the lads. Ha, a good blow. How that tall townsman went down before yonder slim young fellow in the scarlet trencher cap. That is the Lord Kidlingsby," the landlord said. "A lightweight, but a pretty fighter," Mendoza remarked. "L hit with your left, Lord Kidlingsby. Well parried, Lord Kidlingsby. Claret drawn, by Jupiter." "Ours is very fine," the landlord said. "Ill your highness have Chateau Margaux or Laffitte. He never can be going to match himself against that parchman." Raffle exclaimed, "As an enormous boatman no other than Rullock indeed, the most famous bruiser of Cambridge, and before whose fists the gownsman went down like ninepins fought his way up to the spot where, with admirable spirit and resolution, Lord Kidlingsby and one or two of his friends were making head against a number of the town. The young noble faced the huge champion with the gallantry of his race, but was no match for the enemy's strength and weight and sinew, and went down at every round. The brutal fellow had no mercy on the lad. His savage treatment chafed Mendoza as he viewed the unequal combat from the inn window. Hold your hand," he cried to this Goliath. "Don't you see he's but a boy?" "Down he goes again," the bargeman cried, not heeding the interruption. "On he goes again. I like swapping a lord." "Coward!" shouted Mendoza, and to fling open the window amidst a shower of brickbats, to vault over the balcony, to slide down one of the pillars to the ground, was an instant's work. At the next he stood before the enormous bargeman. After the coroner's inquest, Mendoza gave £10,000 to each of the bargeman's 10 children, and it was thus his first acquaintance was formed with Lord Kidlingsby. But we are lingering on the threshold of the house in Holywell Street. Let us go in. 3. Godfrey and Raffle passed from the street into the outer shop of the old mansion in Holywell Street. It was a masquerade warehouse to all appearance. A dark-eyed damsel of the nation was standing at the dark and grimy counter, strewed with old feathers, old yellow hoods, old stage mantles, painted masks, blind and yet gazing at you with a look of sad death-like intelligence from the vacancy behind their sockets. A medical student was trying one of the doublets of orange, tawny and silver, slashed with dirty light blue. He was going to a masquerade that night. He thought Polly Pattens would admire him in the dress. Polly Pattens, the fairest of maids of all work the borough Venus, adored by half the youth of guys. "You look like a prince in it, Mr. Lint," pretty Rachel said, coaxing him with her beady black eyes. "It is the cheese," replied Mr. Lint. "It ain't the dress that don't suit, my Rose of Sharon. It's the figure. Hello, Raffle, is that you, my lad of sealing wax? Come and intersit for me with this wild gazelle. She says I can't have it under 15 bob for the night. And it's too much. Cuss me if it's not too much, unless you'll take my little bill of 2 months, Raffle. There's a sweet pretty brigand's dress you may have for half the munish," Raffle replied. "There's a splendid clown for 8 bob. But for that Spanish dress, silk mamashish, Mistrar Lint, thee'd ask a guinea of any but you. Here's a gentleman's just come to look at it. Look here, Mr. Brownsh, did deliver she a nisher ting dan dat? So saying, Raffle turned to Lord Kidlingsby with the utmost gravity, and displayed to him the garment about which the young medicus was haggling. Cheap at the money, Kidlingsby replied. If you won't make up your mind, sir, I should like to engage it myself. But the thought that another should appear before Polly Patton's in that costume was too much for Mr. Lint. He agreed to pay the 15 shillings for the garment. And Raffle, pocketing the money with perfect simplicity, said, Disvey, Mr. Brownsh. Dear Somerton will shoot you in the next shop. Lord Kidlingsby followed him, wondering. You are surprised at our system, said Raffle, marking the evident bewilderment of his friend. Anfas you would call it meanness my huckstering with yonder young fool. I call it simplicity. Why throw away a shilling without need? Our race never did. A shilling is for men's bread. Shall I disdain to defile my fingers by holding them out relief in their necessity? It is you who are mean, you Normans, not we of the ancient race. You have your vulgar measurement for great things and small. You call £1,000 respectable, and a shekel despicable. Sah, my Kidlingsby. One is as the other. I trade in pennies and in millions. I am above or below neither. They were passing through a second shop, smelling strongly of cedar, and, in fact, piled up with bales of those pencils which the young Hebrews are in the habit of vending through the streets. Have sold bundles and bundles of these, said Raffle. Why, little brother is now out with oranges in Piccadilly. I am bringing him up to be head of our house at Amsterdam. We all do it. I had myself to see Rothschild in Eaton Place this morning, about the Irish loan, of which I have taken 3 millions. And as I wanted to walk, I carried the bag. You should have seen the astonishment of Lotta Latimer, the Archbishop of Croydon's daughter, as she was passing St. Bennet's, Knightsbridge, and as she fancied she recognized in the man who was crying old clothes the gentleman with whom he had talked at the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.